The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's great to be here with you on another live broadcast from our Edstone campus. We've got lots to get to on today's program. We'll talk here in just a bit about the president's address last night, President Trump, his first Oval Office address 2 years into his presidency. And, of course, the media, they were in full-scale panic mode in the lead-up to this address because they desperately don't want the American people to get this message, to get the truth about what's happening at America's southern border. After we go through some of that, we'll look at this fascinating piece at Politico about the rise of populism in Europe. And, of course, if you've been following thetrumpet.com, you know all about this. But Politico makes some conclusions, rather, that are very similar to what you're seeing or what you have been reading at The Trumpet. And then also on today's show, coming up in the last segment, the second segment, we'll continue with our study of history, or the prod that we need to stay grounded in our studies, whether with the study of the Bible or just history and biographies, as I stressed yesterday. And we'll talk about how to make that, or why we should make that library our lifelong companion. Well, as I said at the start there, in the lead up to this address, it was just a 10-minute speech that the president gave last night on live television, and it really is amazing just how much the mainstream media do not want the American people to get this message. They, as you probably know, in the lead up to the speech, they were going back and forth about whether or not they should even carry it live. CNN, there were commentators that were on CNN and other channels talking about how that we shouldn't broadcast this message because, well, it's going to be full of lies, and we don't want to broadcast lies to the American people. They finally did decide to go ahead and run the live transmission of this speech, but in the case of CNN, they had all the Chyron corrections down at the bottom of the screen. They, of course, heard the Democrats scurried around to put together some kind of a rebuttal. Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, they had a 4 or 5 minute response to the speech. As soon as the speech was released, the press typically gets it a little time before the actual address. They were already, some of the commentators had what I guess is called a pre-buttal. You've got the rebuttal that's after the speech, and then the pre-buttal, they're there to help you know what lies are coming. So this is the reaction, the hysterical reaction. Never have we seen this. Oh, Barack Obama had live addresses, and every president before him in our modern era, at least with respect to television. And yet look at the reaction yesterday to something that not that long ago, just a few years ago, this was a subject that really both sides of the aisle could agree upon. Here's a little bit from the president's speech last night, clip one.
Every day, Customs and Border Patrol agents encounter thousands of illegal immigrants trying to enter our country. We are out of space to hold them, and we have no way to promptly return them back home to their country.
So America is in a bind, and the system's overburdened. There's no way to get them back home quickly. And he went on to explain how that it's hurting America, this uncontrolled, illegal immigration. It's hurting minority groups. It's hurting the immigrants themselves in a lot of cases. as I say, these are these used to be talking points that you'd hear from Republicans and Democrats alike. The president went on to say this, clip two.
Last month, 20,000 migrant children were illegally brought into the United States, a dramatic increase. These children are used as human pawns by vicious coyotes and ruthless gangs. One in three women are sexually assaulted on the dangerous trek up through Mexico. Women and children are the biggest victims, by far, of our broken system.
Women and children, not just the ones on this side of the border in the United States, but the ones traveling in the caravans, lots and lots of vulnerable people in these caravans, women and children being abused. One in three, some have said, one in three is he brought out there. Women sexually assaulted while on this dangerous track. The traffickers, they're thriving with this current system. Whether drug traffickers or human traffickers, they're thriving. Something has to be done, said the president. Clip three.
The border wall would very quickly pay for itself. The cost of illegal drugs exceeds $500 billion a year, vastly more than the $5.7 billion we have requested from Congress.
So he did make a big point last night about how that this will cut off at least some of that flow of drugs. Of course, that doesn't deal with the root cause, America's insatiable appetite for drugs, but still, it's something. But then to hear the commentators saying, look, well, the most of the drugs come in through all the ports of entry. So it's not going to do anything. It's not going to help. They tried to justify everything that the president went through. Either that or they just swept it over with a broad brush saying they're all lies. Just a couple more examples here. Clip four.
The federal government remains shut down for one reason. And one reason only, because Democrats will not fund border security.
And of course, this is where they flip out, because they say we're all for border security, we just don't want the wall. And yet, the American Spectator made this point this morning, if they say they're for border security, but they don't want the wall, and then they're all for sanctuary cities, they want to give sanctuary, protection, to the criminals, to the illegals. California, the governor, Newsom, I think his name is, he came out just yesterday or the day before saying he wanted to make the entire state a sanctuary state. Just open defiance against anything and everything that would at least address this problem or secure America's borders. But they don't want that. The president's enemies, some of this too boils down to just opposing it because the president is for it. And that's something that the president touched on toward the end of his address as well. Here's clip five.
Some have suggested a barrier is immoral. Then why do wealthy politicians build walls, fences, and gates around their homes? They don't build walls because they hate the people on the outside, but because they love the people on the inside. The only thing that is immoral is the politicians to do nothing and continue to allow more innocent people to be so horribly victimized.
So many victims, so many people suffering. The most recent example, at least within America, this police officer gunned down by an illegal immigrant there at the end of December. The president alluded to that in his address. But here he is. Here he is facing all of this resistance. And people saying that the barrier is immoral. That putting up a fence is immoral. And this coming from people who just a few years ago, not that long ago, talked about how much we need a barrier. The president called them out. This is clip six.
Senator Chuck Schumer, who you will be hearing from later tonight, has repeatedly supported a physical barrier in the past, along with many other Democrats. They changed their mind only after I was elected president.
So it hasn't even been that long, just a couple of years. Jump ahead, Sam, here to number eight. This is Chuck Schumer in 2009 talking about the progress that they were making with border security back then in the first year of the Obama administration. Clip eight.
The American people need to know that because of our efforts in Congress, our border is far more secure today than it was when we began debating comprehensive reform in 2005. Between 2005 and 2009, a vast amount of progress has been made on our borders and ports of entry. The progress includes 9,000 new Border Patrol field agents in the last 4 years, construction of a 630-mile border fence, or 630 miles of border fence, that create a significant barrier to illegal immigration on our southern land border.
The progress includes, he said back in 2009, it includes construction of 630 miles of border fence, a barrier, he said. Listen to what Hillary Clinton said in 2015. This was just 3 years ago. Clip nine.
I voted numerous times when I was a senator to spend money to build a barrier to try to prevent illegal immigrants from coming in. And I do think you have to control your borders.
That's Hillary Clinton from 2015. You heard Chuck Schumer from 2009. Here's what Chuck Schumer had to say in response to the president's speech last night. Clip seven.
We address you tonight for one reason only. The president of the United States, having failed to get Mexico to pay for his ineffective, unnecessary border wall.
So now it's ineffective and unnecessary. The barrier, the fence that represented a lot of progress back in 2009, now suddenly it's ineffective. Suddenly it's, it's unnecessary. We don't need it. As I said, the president went right through all of these examples, some of these dreadful cases, gruesome crimes. And to hear the talking heads try to just brush that aside, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she talked about the suffering of immigrants in the case of where she used to work at a restaurant. Just listen to this this reasoning, clip 10.
I was working in restaurants just a year ago, and when the president first assumed office with his racist and violent rhetoric, people started to send themselves home. And as we know, in restaurants, hospitality, every American eats if you can, if you're lucky enough, we're able to eat three times a day. And that means that we interact with the people who prepare our food three times a day. When those people start to go home, local, or rather go back to the countries which they originated from, because many of them consider the United States their home, those places, they go into dysfunction. I remember one of our lead cooks brought himself back to Mexico because he was so scared of the president's rhetoric. We had an insane amount of dysfunction. We're talking about local restaurants. We're talking about local businesses. We're talking about shuttering neighborhoods. And we're talking about people feeling unsafe.
So that's the up and coming congresswoman. She's new to the job, getting lots and lots of media time for sure. But she's pointing to what she sees as violent rhetoric from Donald Trump because he wants to build a barrier, and how that in this case someone was so scared because of his rhetoric that he moved back to Mexico, one of the lead cooks. Meanwhile, you have actual cases of gruesome violence, like this officer being gunned down, and his family, his son, his children agonizing. And then the case, as the president brought out last night, this Air Force veteran who was raped and murdered, beaten to death with a hammer. That crime committed by an illegal alien, one that had a long criminal history. And then the example in Georgia, another illegal, murdering, beheading, dismembering his neighbor. This is actual violence. in Maryland, the MS-13 gang member that viciously, as the president said last night, stabbed and beat to death a 16-year-old girl. And yet, it's an endless cycle on so many of the news channels with talking heads like Ocasio-Cortez saying that it's President Trump who's violent. It's President Trump who's scaring people. Well, this is a subject, I'm sure, that's going to not go away. And with the partial government shutdown, again, you can expect the media to continue its resistance. It's just getting to the point. I forget who it was. I think she's at the Federalist. One commentator who said, when you look at the way the media approaches its job now, it's hard to take them serious. To see, I just played a few clips for you, but to just roll through the clip list this morning, to see the general reaction to a 10-minute speech about border security and about building a wall, something that the president, that was his primary campaign promise, to build a wall. He's trying to follow through, but he can't. He can't. Well, there's other news to get to. This piece at Politico, but to set it up, let me just go through a bit from the Telegraph first about what the Telegraph sees as a geostrategic dystopia. This Western liberal order, how it's being turned on its head, these great alliances. This is the year, the article says, that serial hammer blows to the Western alliance system and the edifice of global governance threaten to bring the old order tumbling down. And then it brings out, again, some of the things you've been reading about at the Trumpet, the Trumpet.com website. Pax Americana, how that's unraveling. You have the transatlantic alliance, the United States, NATO. That's dying. It says NATO, the G7, the G20, the WTO, and the EU are all in varying degrees of crisis. Here is the world order, as I say, being turned on its head. The Telegraph says anti-liberal strongmen are tugging away at the edges in Turkey, Brazil, and Hungary. Some in the twilight zones of the democratic world are drifting towards the Putin-Xi camp. Russia, China, that's prophesied. It says U.S. alliances everywhere are weakening. The limited trust that underpins the U.S.-China relationship appears to be gone. It says the dystopian picture is grim enough, even at this late stage of global economic expansion, which begs the question, what would happen in a deep recession with mass unemployment? We brought this out yesterday. What happens? What happens during the next global recession? It says Eurasia Group warned that 2019 could turn out to be the year the world falls apart. 2019, here we are, a new calendar year. This article here says there is much ruin in a great geopolitical order, to paraphrase Adam Smith. Well, this group that it cites, the Eurasia Group, it talks about the rise of these populist movements all across Europe. Here's a bit from the Eurasia Group, clip 11.
The populist tide will continue to rise in Europe this year. Populist parties will win more seats than ever before in European parliamentary elections this May. That will give them a bigger role in EU government institutions, where they can challenge current European policy on migration, trade, and democracy. At the same time, populists will get even stronger in France and Italy, Europe's third and fourth largest economies. The erosion of the EU from within will accelerate, and its resilience to crisis will weaken.
And so the rise of these populist groups or movements to go from something like 28% in the European Parliament to 37%. And as you heard there at the end of that clip, the erosion, this is bringing on the erosion of the EU from within. But as Political brings out this other piece, if you thought that the populists wanted to kill the EU, you're wrong. There's something much worse that's coming, as Richard pointed out this morning. This is probably the first time we've seen someone or some publication besides the Trumpet make this point. Here we have all these populist leaders and movements all across Europe. And what is it leading to? Europe will change. A transformation is coming. But this is not the end of the European project. This is not the end of European unity. Politico says, with harsh words for Brussels and displays of affection for illiberal leaders like Russian President Vladimir Putin and U.S. President Donald Trump, they are perceived as being entirely focused on clawing back power for national governments at the expense of European integration. The truth is far more troubling. It says here, in government, far-right populists are less likely to want to bring down the EU to their and everybody else's disadvantage than to try to work the EU system to their advantage, harnessing it to their agenda. It's easy to look at what's happening in Europe and just think that, well, all of these populist movements, all of these far-right populists, they're just automatically anti-EU. They're against the EU. They want to see it break up. They want to return to their nation state, and that's it. It says here, radical intellectual milieus in states like France, Italy, and Austria are shifting their focus from bringing about the EU's downfall toward a sustained effort to put European integration in the service of a particular set of ideological goals. Rather than seeking to dismantle the EU, such movements are looking at how it can be reshaped to make it capable of projecting strength internally and externally against ideological opponents or emerging geopolitical rivals. That's pretty amazing when you're seeing words like reshaped. Again, this is like the Trumpet. This is what the Trumpet's been saying for years. Years and years and years. Richard Palmer had a piece back in 2016 talking about how that in the wake of Brexit, again, there's opposition growing within national governments. He pointed to Germany and others in Eastern Europe. There is strong opposition to Brussels, to the bureaucrats, but they also want a common defense. They also want a united military. Switching back to this Politico piece, it says, rather than dismantle the EU, just listen to this quote, rather than dismantle the EU, far-right populists could help accelerate the militarization of the EU in order to project collective power into states along the EU's borders in a quasi-imperial fashion. They want a stronger EU. That's what will be the result of this. All of these so-called populist movements, what does the Bible say? It talks about a strong man coming out of Germany. That's in Daniel 8 and 11. And then Revelation 17 says there's going to be 10 strong kings rallying around the strong man. 10 kings. That tells us that a Europe is coming that's going to be a superpower. It's going to shock the world. Mr. Armstrong, in some of the clips we've played in years past about this shocking the world, about how that it happens suddenly, and how that if you put these 10 nations together, all of a sudden you've got a population of 300-400 million people. This is what's coming. They don't want more Brussels. They don't want more bureaucracy, these populist movements, but they do want more Europe. They do want a stronger Europe. And like Richard brought out in that 2016 piece, there's nothing more Europe than a strong king and a European army. That's been the history. Just last year, January of 2018, about a year ago now, this is another one from Richard Palmer. It says, European Union bureaucrats are struggling to deal with a new type of leader. He's not sophisticated, multicultural, and managerial. He is not soft. He's not soft, consensus-building, and wary of giving offense. He's strong. He's patriotic. He's decisive. He's everything the European Commission in Brussels is not. European bureaucrats hate him. Yet this type of leader is emerging in country after country. It says whether bureaucrats like it or not, these strong men are Europe's future. Yes, indeed. The bureaucrats in Brussels, they may resist, but this is Europe's future. 10 kings. You can read my father's article from 2017. Wanted, a leader for Europe. That's what they want. He has the booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. That's what your Bible prophesies. It says, my father wrote, to see what is ahead for Europe, for European unity, look at what is behind. In other words, look at history. If you want to see where Europe is headed, then you just need to delve into a little bit of history, and that will lead us right into what I want to cover in the next segment, following on our study from yesterday's show. If you want to see where Europe is headed, just look at the history. Look at what's been happening. Look at what happened in the last century. Look at what happened with Napoleon in the 1800s, the early 1800s. We're watching for it. All of this dissatisfaction and unrest, all of these populist movements, it's about to bring about a political transformation all across Europe. A united Europe, a beast power with a united military, a superpower that shocks the world. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program and possibly have it read live on the air, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Yesterday, I went through this article by Hal Brands about the historical profession, how that it's committing this slow motion suicide. And he said right at the end, I don't think I got to this quote at the end of the show, but it's at the end of his article, and he says, few historians would quarrel with the notion that more historical knowledge makes for smarter public policy. Few would contest the idea that a historically uninformed population is more susceptible to conspiratorial thinking and an inability to differentiate fake news from the real thing. Yet academic historians simply are not focusing their efforts on some of the issues that matter most to the fate of the United States and the international system today. It says, instead of possessing deep historical knowledge that serves as the intellectual foundation for effective policy and informed debate, the nation risks worsening historical ignorance with all its attendant dangers. There's just an ignorance that sets in, as I covered in the first part of the last segment. Here, the history from just a few years ago is being revised. Or at the very least, they're not called upon to explain themselves. If the president gives a 10-minute speech and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have a 5-minute rebuttal, maybe the first thing they could bring up is, look, this is what we believed 3 years ago, and here is why we've changed our belief. Here's why we've altered our stance. I used to vote for a barrier, but now I don't. You don't hear anything like that. You just hear it's immoral. It's unnecessary. It's ineffective. And it doesn't matter that that's not what they said 3 years ago. They just say it, and they say it over and over and over again. They're guilty of what they accuse the president of. One lie after another after another. And they're never held to account. Historical revisionism happening almost in real time. But to dwell on the point here for a moment in this Hal Brands piece, the dangers for this worsening historical ignorance, as he puts it. History repeats itself, and we won't even know it when it happens. When the beast power emerges again, the seventh resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, that's a lot of repeated history, isn't it? It's just one after another, and here we go again. The same old problem coming out of the heart of Europe. It's important for us to know something about that. Above all, to know what God says about it, what God prophesies. Victor Davis Hanson had a great piece at National Review yesterday about the problem with higher education. He didn't dwell on history specifically, but he did touch on it in his article. He says that if you look at the university in America today, medicine, business, those kinds of fields, America's still the best. But then you look into the liberal arts department, the social sciences, and what has happened? What has happened? He says, few believe anymore that current liberal arts programs have prepared graduates to write persuasively and elegantly, to read critically, and to think inductively, while drawing on a wide body of literary, linguistic, historical, artistic, and philosophical knowledge. You just don't see it anymore. It says colleges, and he says, of course, there's an occasional exception, but colleges, for the most part, they do not ensure the teaching of such skills anymore. Further on, he says, by and large, the bachelor's degree, even in a liberal arts major, no longer certifies that a graduate will be able to read, reason, compute, or draw on a body of knowledge far more effectively than those without an undergraduate degree. He says the decline of the university has been an ongoing tragedy since the 1960s. But the erosion has accelerated because of ideological bias and its twin, incompetence. This is the problem. This is why you can't get to the truth. This is why lies just routinely are reported as facts. Because of this historical ignorance. This worsening historical ignorance. And think of the attendant dangers associated with it. Bias, incompetence. Hansen says most college courses in literature and history, despite their sometimes anachronistic and traditional titles, focus on diversity. That is, they present a play or a novel or a past historical period or event in terms of how it adversely portrayed or affected the poor, women, and minorities. The larger agenda is ideological, to instruct how the superior present can craft remedies to ensure that incorrect thinking and the biases throughout history and literature do not contaminate contemporary life and society. That's all that they're concerned with. They have to go back. If they even do cover history, if they even do discuss history, they've got to cover it this way. The focus has to be on diversity. It's like I said yesterday with the Howard Zinn book. It's the people's history. That's who we need to focus on. Not the great men and women of history. The masses of people. The people who are oppressed. The victims. The poor. The minorities. That sort of thing. Not that there's anything wrong with some study about that. But look at what's being left out. As Hansen says, what's often forgotten is that political correctness comes at a price of not learning a language, or reading the plays of Shakespeare, or mastering the basic outlines of the Civil War or World War II. That's the cost. The focus on diversity, multiculturalism. And what's left out? Well, just the basic outline of what happened in World War II. Listen to his conclusion. It says, today's students, this is Victor Davis Hanson at National Review, today's students, like their professors, not only do not possess, but feel no need to possess familiarity with Thucydides or Dante's Inferno or some idea of the Napoleonic Wars or the work of T.S. Eliot. And at least one reason they do not is that teaching and reading these texts and studying complex histories are far more difficult tasks than various therapeutic studies courses about prejudices, biases, and isms and ologies. He says, finally, becoming woke is not the same as being educated. The former is easy. The former is easy and seeks the affirmation of the majority. The latter is harder and often a lonely experience. It's hard and sometimes lonely. It's a lonely experience because there's not very many that do it anymore. And you're not getting it in the college classroom. Maybe solitary is a better word than lonely, because if you're immersed in the book, you do have a companion. You've got quite a few companions. It's a wonderful experience. If it's just the best, as I stressed yesterday, the best works of history, the best biographies, or in the case of the Bible, the best period, then what a companion it will be. Andrew Roberts, and this is a point that Richard made in a trumpet brief a few weeks ago, he talks about Winston Churchill's living sense of history. That's Andrew Roberts' new biography, or I guess it's been out a little over a year now. But he talked about how often Winston Churchill drew upon these great events from Britain's own history. And because of that, because of his understanding of history, he was able to see the problem right away with trying to appease the dictator there in the late 1930s. But the other point that Roberts makes about Churchill is that he also had all these references to historical events and leaders of Britain's past that the rest in Britain could identify with. He made the British, like Richard brought out in that trumpet brief, he made the British feel like they were living, that they were making history. Listen to this speech. I'll just read an excerpt for you. This was right at in the dog days of 1940. London being bombed all through the summer. And Churchill, he inspired his people. He rallied the people. He said, "It ranks with the days when the Spanish Armada was approaching the Channel and Drake was finishing his game of bowls," it says. "And when Nelson stood between us and Napoleon's Grand Army," it says, we've read all about this in the history books, but what is happening now is on a far greater scale and of far more consequence to the life and future of the world and its civilization than these brave old days of the past." Churchill said right in the middle there, "We've read about all of this in the history books." And the fact is, the audience he was addressing, the British people, they had read about it. They were still, at least they were still studying this in high school, at college, in the university. But the same could not be said today. You couldn't imagine Churchill getting behind a microphone like this and just carrying on with Drake or Churchill, or sorry, Nelson, the Spanish Armada. It's hard enough today just to get people to focus in on Churchill. That's not even that far back. This prophesied watchman. Because they're not learning it, they're not studying it, they're not engaging in this sometimes lonely experience, to use the words of Victor Davis Hanson. And because of that, we're losing perspective. We're lost in the present, as my father wrote in the book of Chronicles. He said, God is always challenging his people to keep the overview, to see the grand sweep, both historically and prophetically. In another article at thetrumpet.com, Joel Hilliker, he said, "The better you understand history, the better you can understand why our ignorance of it is so dangerous, and the more you can see why we cannot afford to get lost in the present." And so we've got to accept this challenge that God puts before us, that my father gave us in the Chronicles book. We've got to keep the overview. We've got to understand or see the grand sweep of history. You put it together with prophecy and look at what we're able to see. Look at all that we're able to see in Daniel 9. Just a few scriptural examples here before we conclude. Verse 1, it says, "In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of this king, Darius the king," it says, "I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the word of the Eternal came to Jeremiah the prophet that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. He studied his Bible. He studied his history books. He understood by the books. My father in the Daniel booklet, he says he studied hard. This is Daniel, the prophet. He studied hard and was brilliant because of it. God wants us to bear down like Daniel and to understand what these prophecies are all about. That means putting in diligent, earnest study. God's making us study hard to really get it. We have to have, like in the other quote I gave yesterday, we have to have an organized plan. This can't be a casual or routine study. We've got to get methodical. We've got to lay out the goals. We've got to put those goals to paper and then start chipping away at it. I just started, by the way, this Napoleon biography that we're going to be going through this next semester for the Edstone Book Club. And even just 10, 15 pages in, just fascinating, illuminating. Hopefully the rest of the book is as good as the opening pages. It's the same author I just quoted from earlier, Andrew Roberts, the one that wrote the Churchill biography. A great historian. You know, one of the points that Victor Davis Hanson made in that piece I read a moment ago is that just to show you what's happened to the university, he pointed out how that you just don't see so many of these great works of history written by professors anymore. There still are great biographies, thankfully. And there's no wonder when you consider what you're not getting at the university in those social sciences departments or the liberal arts departments. It's no wonder there's at least some appetite. It's a dwindling minority for sure. But no wonder there's an appetite for works like Chernow's book on Ulysses S. Grant. Because this is history that's just been forgotten. No one cares to teach about this history. They've got to just get into diversity and multiculturalism. If you're in the college classroom, that's all that you get. Well, Solomon said of the making of many books, there's no end. They're all over the place now, and so Satan uses that even to just drown out the truth. Look at what most people, if they do read, look at what they're reading, look at what they're immersed into, and then consider what they're missing because they're caught up in so many trivial things, so many worldly things, just lost in the present. Daniel understood by books. The Bereans in Acts 17, they understood by books, their study of them. And you see references in the Old Testament time and again to books that didn't even make it into the canon. Books that prophets of God studied through. And so much of it revolved around history. Earlier on in the book of Daniel here, chapter 1, it says in verse 3, and the king spoke to Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should be bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom and cunning in knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. So he wanted these Jewish lads, the learned ones, the ones who are skillful in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge. That word learning, in the couple of verses I just read, it actually can mean books. Here again, Daniel understood by books. Down in verse 17, listen to this. It says, as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So in addition to what they were reading and studying, God opened their mind to understand a whole lot more. That's the way God will work with us. If we show ourselves to be diligent, if we dig into the books, if we understand by the books, God will just open our minds to understand all the more. Now, we can certainly tie in prayer with this this formula as well. It says in 1 Kings 3, God says this, "I've given you a wise and understanding heart so that there was none like you before you, neither after you shall any arise like unto you." That's God speaking of Solomon and how that God gives inspiration and understanding. But like I say, it's a two-way operation. Daniel received this understanding from God, but he applied himself to his studies, to letters, to literature. Napoleon wrote 33,000 letters over the course of his, when did he die? I think he was 52 when he died. 33,000 letters. And he didn't start writing letters till he was a teenager. So you deduct those early years when he wasn't writing. Just an incredible amount of, and he was, of course, he was a voracious reader. Surprise, surprise. It was just a different time. The skill, the communication skills, the leadership ability, the level of study and scholarship. You put that together with God's understanding. You bring God into your studies. Well, consider this verse again. The Living Bible says, God gave these four youths great ability to learn, and they soon mastered all the literature and science of the time. These were studiers. They were students. They mastered all the literature, all the science of the time. It wasn't just the Bible. The Bible's the foundation, like Herbert Armstrong often said. And then you add to that, a couple of weeks ago, well, I guess this goes back to November, I went through that I think it was a Federalist piece, about how that Americans, how we're suffering today because we don't understand what freedom is about. We don't understand those founding documents. We've forgotten them. And like I quoted on that program, I think this was right around Thanksgiving, that quote from Thomas Jefferson, he said, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be." It's impossible to hold on to all of these freedoms and to be ignorant at the same time. Education is the key to maintaining those liberties that so many of us now take for granted. We have a duty. We have a duty to study, to show ourselves approved to God, as it says in 2 Timothy 2. We have a responsibility to, as Dennis Leap brought out in his show yesterday, to teach our children. You can see this all through the book of Deuteronomy. To teach them how to fall in love with study, learning, understanding, craving knowledge. I think it was in that same program around Thanksgiving that we referred to that program, or rather that revival in 2 Chronicles 34, this great awakening brought on by King Josiah, a young man, a remarkable young king in Judah. He went in there and just obliterated all of these pagan idols, this pagan worship, this pagan system. Judah's identity had been lost. And as the Federalist summarized, it says, "Then one day a priest stumbled upon the long-lost book of the law. While going through the temple, he announced his discovery to King Josiah, who was deeply moved by the rediscovery of the law and his people's true heritage, and he led a great awakening. He came upon this book of the law, perhaps penned by Moses himself, and it led to a rediscovery, to learning things about their history that they had forgotten. You can learn it all over again just by delving into it, reading and studying, making those books, making that library your lifelong companion. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Send us an email this week, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.